From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The HBO series Enlightened begins season 2 in January. It's part comedy, part drama, about coping with the stress of daily life. It was co-created by Mike White, who wrote School of Rock, and Laura Dern, who stars in the series. White says the show was inspired, in part, by his own stress-induced meltdown. When a psychiatrist sent White for treatment, he was surprised to find himself in a hospital.
I was thinking I was going to go to, like, the Ritz-Carlton and, like, have a burger and some tranquilizers or something. And it was much more, like, I was, you know, like, people were shuffling around, like, you know, clearly medicated. I was like, I'm not crazy. I'm just really stressed.
Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead remembers three of his favorite saxophonists who died earlier this year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Next month, the HBO series Enlightened will be back in a big way. The DVD box set of Season 1 is scheduled for release January 8th, and Season 2 begins on HBO just a few days later, on January 13th. Enlightened was co-created by today's guests, actress Laura Dern, who stars, and Mike White, who also wrote for the TV shows Freaks and Geeks and Dawson's Creek, and the screenplays for the films School of Rock and Nacho Libre. Terry Gross spoke with Laura Dern and Mike White in 2011 when Enlightened premiered on HBO. The conversation began with Mike White, and Laura Dern joined partway through. In Enlightened, Dern plays Amy Jellicoe, an executive at a global conglomerate who suffers a meltdown at work and has an attitude-changing epiphany during her stay at a holistic mental health treatment facility. She returns to work, but in a much more menial role. Yet she's determined to make a difference and to make her company more caring and responsible, to the environment and to its workers. Mike White plays one of those workers. In the premiere episode, Amy has just returned home. Well, not exactly home. She's moved in with her mother, played by Laura Dern's real-life mother, Diane Ladd. And now Amy is facing a strained relationship with her mother and a demotion at work. She's trying to maintain the calm that she found meditating in Hawaii, but it isn't easy. In this scene, she's seated cross-legged on her bed, beginning to meditate.
Breathe, relax into my body, totally present, focusing on one spot. I see my hand, I see wrinkles. My skin. I'm 40. I'm severely dehydrated. I need to drink more water. Relax. Breathe. Picturing yourself somewhere calming.
Mike White, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you back again. Congratulations on this new series. That scene that we just heard is a great illustration of the way you can just start judging or attacking yourself while you're trying to sit still and breathe and get in a meditative state. But this is the only series I can think of that's trying to deal with like the difficulty of getting into a meditative state, of quieting your noisy brain, of trying to be your better self, and then the difficulty once you've gotten there of staying there. What made you think of this as the idea of a series?
Well, the truth is I kind of had my own process of getting into some of these, like meditating and yoga, and it came out of a really bad TV experience where I was running a show where by the end of the show, I was like sent the crazy email in the middle of the night to everybody and had sort of a nervous breakdown over the whole thing. I was just kind of overworked, and I'd gone through like a period of years where I was just burning my candle at both ends, and you know, made like 4 movies and 2 TV shows in the span of like 5 years. And I realized I had to like mellow out a little bit and try to not to be such a workaholic. And I didn't know how to do that. And I also wanted to try to assert to everybody else that I wasn't crazy. And so I thought that, you know, it took me a while to have the guts to go back to TV because it had been so brutal. But when they did, you know, HBO came to me and when Laura and I started talking about a show together, I liked the idea of somebody who was, had kind of come to the edge and then wanted to come back and try to get over themselves, I guess.
So what was your pitch to HBO?
Laura had her own, you know, she actually had the deal at HBO first. She, thematically, she wanted to do something about somebody who wanted to be an agent of change. And the idea changed a lot once I got involved, but that part of it was something that appealed to me as well, to tackle the idea of somebody whose main goal is not so much like, you know, dating or family or, you know, relationships, but was something kind of had a bigger ambition. And yet she wasn't like a forensics, you know, police investigator.
You know, she wants to be her better self. And she was that person, the better self, when she was at the holistic rehab center or holistic therapy center in Hawaii, where like it was beautiful with the waves on the beach and the glorious sunrises and everybody like singing around the campfire. But then, you know, she gets home and, you know, it's back to work and to the grind and the traffic, and it's just impossible to hold on to that better self. Did you experience that at all? When you'd taken some time away from work, you'd studied a little bit of Buddhism and this and that, and then you're like you're throwing yourself back into like, you know, the stress again, and then what?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It kind of paralleled actually the making of the show for me, because, you know, when I'm not working as much and I'm not stressed, my better side comes out, and I'm, you know, I can have time for other people and I can be patient. And the stress of running a TV show is, you know, it's really a round the clock kind of pressure. And if you want it to be a good show, you can kind of make yourself crazy. And so, yeah, I mean, like, you know, all of my old kind of compulsive tweaker habits started to, you know, emerge while I was even making the show. So it's harder to put some of that sort of Buddhist philosophy into practice once you're outside of the cushier berth of the meditation room, you know, or the yoga room.
So did you actually go on a retreat like the character in your TV series did? Or did you, were you in?
Well, it was more freaky than that. What happened was I had this kind of breakdown at work when I was running this TV show, and I started having panic attacks, and then basically I woke up one morning and I was like thinking I was having a heart attack. I was having a panic attack. I'd never had one before, so I didn't really know what was going on. I thought I was just dying. I was dying. And so I went to see some psychiatrist, and I was like, you know, he was like asking me if I was like suicidal. And I was like, well, I just want to throw myself in front of a bus, but you know, it's nothing more than that. But
excuse me for laughing.
Nothing that, you know, whatever, the typical stuff. But, and so like the next thing you know, I was like actually being checked into like a hospital where I was like, you know, not going to have my own room. You know, I was thinking I was going to go to like the Ritz-Carlton and like have a burger and some tranquilizers or something. And it was much more like I was, you know, like people were shuffling around, like, you know, clearly medicated. I was like, I'm not crazy. I'm just really stressed. And I, you know, I need to, this is just going to make it worse. I'm not, you know, this isn't right. So I like escaped this place, just ran to my car and like got in my car. And the psychiatrist had taken it upon himself. I don't know why I'm telling this story, but might as well. But he had called my office and said, oh yeah, Mike's not coming back. He's going somewhere where he can get the help that he needs. And I was like, and so there are all these people who were leaving messages on my machine, all of these producers and studio executives and network executives, it is, who are like crying and being like, don't worry about the show, just get your get the help. And I was heading back to work, and I was like, this is not gonna I don't really know what to do. And so like within a few days the show had been shut down, and I was like, it was over. And so it kind of just, you know, it was like I was like, you know, a cartoon character who like the Wile E. Coyote that just slams against a wall, and then is like, you know, butterflies flying over my head. Like I didn't know where to go. I just didn't know what to do. I just knew that I had completely bombed out. So yeah, I mean, I went through this period where I was just like, what do I do now? So and that feeling like, you know, just going back and burying myself in work, which is what I used to do, just didn't seem like the healthiest response.
So did you go someplace away?
I never went to like, no, I never went. I mean, I never did that. I did start like meditating and stuff, but I've always been sort of afraid of like meditating in like a big group setting because I didn't think I could hack it. But I have done that, some of that more now. But it was really more just a kind of a walkabout where I was just traveling and reading and just trying to just calm down.
Did you find it hard to do that? And did you find it hard to quiet your mind and just sit alone with yourself?
Yeah, well, like in like Amy, in that episode that, you know, you played the clip from, I feel is very true to my experience, which is like, you know, meditating can bring up the most stressful thoughts, you know, especially if you haven't done a lot of it. And to actually try to stop that constant chatter of, you know, I need to do this, I need to do that, this is what's wrong with me. I think that's the hardest thing for many people to do, especially in our modern, you know, kind of like achievement oriented, you know, everybody's running around so manic. It's I think one of the most difficult things. And what's interesting too is I think when we turned in the show, the sort of more quiet, meditative aspects of the show made HBO the most nervous. And what, just what? In general, it was like, well, just because I think people, you know, especially with in TV, first they want their comedies funny and they want their dramas juicy and kind of operatic. And this is very internal. And especially these kind of moments that Amy has where she's really sort of going in inside and where it slows down a little bit. I think that that's something that just in general makes a network executive worry that you're going to lose your audience and people are going to click off or change the channel. That's not what people are looking for when they're zoning out in front of the TV.
So one more thing. So you have this kind of breakdown because the stress of this TV show that you were running was just too much. And then so you go to a psychiatric facility, escape from there. And then the show's shut down a few days later. So on top of all the stress you were feeling, did you then feel guilt, too, that the show's shut down because you were gone?
Yeah. Well, also because, you know, when you're running a show, there's like at least, you know, hundreds of people, maybe not hundreds, but over 100 people who are making their living off the show. So when that happened, yeah, you feel like, you know, yeah, you've really bombed out. And especially when it's a show, like I had actors that were really good actors. You know, you sort of feel like you're hosting a party and then the party sucks and it just doesn't end. And so like every day you're like, there was so much fighting on that particular show between what I was trying to do and what the network wanted from the show. And by the end, when, you know, and trying to compromise and make everybody happy, I just kind of made something that nobody was happy with. Not me, not the network. You just sort of feel like you just like every day have to show up and be like, I know this party sucks, but I don't know what to do. And I don't know how to get out of it. And so it was just like this constant. Yeah. And then when it all fell apart, in a way, I was kind of relieved just because I didn't have to see everyone. I was just kind of failing alone now back in my house, which I'm more comfortable with. But it was definitely an alter, you know, but I do think that those kinds of things, and this is very Buddhist too, which is something that feels like the worst case scenario at the time can often be the gift, you know. That was a huge kind of life experience and a maturation experience for me. And it was very meaningful to me and it helped me direct me in a way that hopefully, you know, I am living my life a little bit more in a kind of saner way, I guess.
Mike White speaking with Terry Gross in 2011. Season 1 of Enlightened is released on DVD January 8th, and Season 2 begins on HBO January 13th. Let's take a short break, and then Laura Dern will join the conversation. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2011 interview with Mike White, writer and co-creator of the HBO series Enlightened. Joining the conversation is Laura Dern, who co-created the series and stars in it. She plays a business executive who has a nervous breakdown, is transformed by therapy and meditation at a holistic health retreat, and returns to her old corporate environment, which doesn't exactly welcome her or her new ideas with open arms. Laura Dern became famous after starring in Blue Velvet.
Laura, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Let's hear a scene in which you, Laura Dern, appear with your mother, Diane Ladd, who plays your mother in the series. And this is from the first episode of the series. You've just come back from your holistic treatment center retreat in Hawaii, and you're trying really hard to hold on to the calm that you found there. So you've brought back with you an exercise that was recommended at the retreat, and you're going to try it with your mother.
Mother, they have asked me to write a letter to the person I have the most difficulty communicating with. It was not hard for me to decide who that person is.
How long is this going to take?
Do you have somewhere to be?
No. I just wanted to know how long this is going to take.
Not long. I've just got to read you what's on these papers.
Well, I can read, honey.
But I'm supposed to read it to you, Mom. That's the point.
Okay, Amy.
You and I have been through a lot. Dad's death, all of Bethany's issues, my divorce, money problems. You name it, we have dealt with it. I know I have disappointed you in many ways. And yes, there have been times that you've disappointed me. But I want to change that. And I truly believe that we can change. And if we can change, anything is possible. If we can change, the whole world can change for the better.
I don't know what that means, honey.
Mom, can you just let me finish and we'll talk after.
Is this what they asked you to do up there?
One of the things, yeah.
And what medications did they give you?
Mom, nothing. I'm off my medication.
Well, why on earth?
Mom, I don't want to talk about my medications. I'm here reading you.
I just want to be sure that you are okay.
Okay,
Look, don't get irritated with me because I just want what's best for you. That is all I have ever wanted. Ginger's been pawing at me, so I really need to take her. I'm going to take her out. Ginger, come on. Come on with Mama.
And Ginger is, of course, the mother's dog. Who hasn't experienced something like that where you're trying to get a fresh start with a relationship of somebody who you were really close to and really care about but don't get along with well, maybe your parent, maybe somebody else, and it's just not possible? Like they're not willing to talk to you on your terms. You're speaking two separate languages. Did you feel like you had been there, Laura Dern, when you were performing this clip?
Yes. yes. It just is so perfectly captured and so tragically funny to me.
Did you go through it with your mother, who you're enacting the scene with?
You know, in my own way, I've been talking about what it's like working with her, and I've got to say the pleasure of working with her as a 40-year-old versus a 20-year-old was extremely different. She's, you know, obviously an incredible pro, and despite not bringing the relationship into work, there is some inevitability to it. But this is such a different dynamic. You know, she and I kind of say everything to each other, and this is the opposite kind of mother-daughter relationship. But yet still, to look in her eyes, there's, you know, forever a lot unsaid, you know, in a parent-child relationship. So you know, it's moving and also hilarious, but she gets the joke, so it makes it possible.
Did you know when you wanted to do a series for HBO that you would want your mother in it?
I didn't. You know, when Mike and I first started talking, we were focusing on so many other issues, just about what Mike wanted to say, what I was hopeful to, you know, hear and witness in Amy's character.
They've worked together in so many great projects before. You know, usually Diane plays this sort of more kind of domineering or just kind of larger than life, you know, and I just thought it would be interesting because the mother in this is so kind of shut down and kind of trying to keep a lid on all of the emotional issues. And it kind of felt exciting to have that sort of dynamic turned in this between them as actresses.
Mike, can you talk about writing the scene that we just heard in which Amy is trying to really have this communication with her mother and her mother doesn't speak the same language?
I feel like I've been on both sides of those kinds of moments. You have people that, you know, like in AA, you know, you have friends who go to AA and then they come back and they want to like do their sort of come to Jesus with you and sort of like, hey, I'm sorry I did this. And I, you know, like and have their catharsis, but it's kind of on their timetable. It's like, you know, okay, great, you're fixed now, but I'm not really ready to have this conversation. And, you know, like, maybe you feel like this is like you're saying sorry for all the things you did, but it's kind of like, it's in a weird way, it in the moment, it's almost feels selfish. It feels like it's really just about getting something off their chest for them. And I can relate to the mom sort of being like, why now? Why is, you know, like, I don't want to talk about this now. At the same time, I think there's just something very moving of, you know, when Amy says, you know, if we can change, the whole world can change. You know, when certain relationships are so entrenched in a certain kind of narrative where somebody's this and, you know, the mother's disappointed, you know, like whatever the backstory to certain relationships, and you feel like there's no way this can ever change. And when she's asserting, like, look, if we can change our dynamic, anything is possible. This would be the most hopeful experience that would be transcendent beyond just our relationship. It just means that things, people can actually change, and then, and yet they don't change.
Do you think people are capable of change, or that you in particular are capable of change? Do you feel like
I do?
You do?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Prove it.
I mean, like, to me, I feel like
what have
I mean,
you really changed in your life?
I mean, I think that there are certain ways that people, you know, are always themselves, but I do think people change. And I feel like that is the hopefulness that I think the show tries to get at. And I do think that, yeah, we're all human and nobody's perfect and we're all sort of fumbling towards something better. But if, you know, if we don't believe that we can change and kind of like maturate in some way or kind of get over ourselves, then I don't know, it's a pretty depressing kind of resolution, I guess.
Mike White and Laura Dern speaking with Terry Gross in 2011. They'll be back in the second half of the show. Season 1 of their HBO series, Enlightened, will be released on DVD in January. Also next month, Season 2 will begin on HBO. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. From the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Jazz lost some great saxophonists this year. Coming up, critic Kevin Whitehead remembers three who passed: Vaughn Freeman, Lowell Coxhill, and Sean Bergen. And we hear more of our conversation with Laura Dern and Mike White. Their HBO series Enlightened begins its second season in January. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Let's hear more of Terry's 2011 interview with Mike White and Laura Dern, co-creators of the HBO series Enlightened. Season 1 of the comedy drama will be released on DVD on January 8th, and Season 2 begins on HBO January 13th. In Enlightened, Dern plays a business executive who has an anger problem and has a public meltdown in the office. She goes to a holistic mental health center in Hawaii where she learns to meditate. She finds a new calm within herself and feels transformed. She not only wants to maintain that new self, which she finds really difficult to do after she returns home and the stress builds and the anger resurfaces, but she also wants to change her relationship with family and colleagues, even though they resist it.
You know, I think one of the reasons why people like in their late teens or early 20s have to leave home, whether it's to go to out-of-town college or just like to move to another place or start a new life someplace else, is because sometimes in order to change, you have to leave behind the people who insist that you are who you are and you can't mm-hmm. be anybody different. But that's an opportunity that adult life doesn't always offer you. You know, you may have children. You're not going to leave them. You may have a job and you can't, you know, you may have reasons why you can't move or change neighborhoods or go anywhere. And it makes it so much harder to change when people insist that you are who you are. And it really, I think sometimes people won't allow you to change.
And this is something that we continue to see in Mike's writing, and it's such a delicate art, but that Mike so beautifully writes about incremental growth. And I think so many film writers, you know, want to tackle this enormous growth where this villain becomes a hero in the hour and a half we have with them. And in this sort of long form of this season, Mike has this opportunity and so beautifully walks this line of Amy having this longing for growth and longing for some form of self-acceptance, but this drive, you know, it's like, I will change everyone in my life if it kills me and them too. If we all go down, I will make sure the world is a better place. And so there's this very complicated and elusive journey toward growth that she takes that has, you know, as you said, have we grown in our own life? You know, yes, she grows, and hopefully I have in my own way, but there's always, you know, the 10 steps backward that we can take at any given moment back into old pattern, you know?
Mike, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think that what your question is very, it is interesting to me because I think that, you know, I think why certain relationships fall apart is because people get tired of the person that they have become in the relationship or the way the narrative is framed about the relationship. And it's like, I'm not this person and I'm tired of being kind of reflected in this way. And, you know, there's an episode where she takes her ex-husband up to the Kern River where they used to go when they were still in love and young. And she thinks she's going to kind of, I don't know, somehow escape the hard, darker parts of their relationship. Somehow she's going to reclaim this kind of innocence. And instead she realizes he's brought drugs up there and all of her sort of idealism is kind of squashed. But by the end, you know, as she goes back into her internal monologue, we do see that there's, yeah, that some kind of incremental change has happened inside of how she feels about him and how she feels about herself. And it is a positive change. And so, you know, we can't, you know, sometimes we fall short of our idealistic goals for other people, ourselves, our relationships. But that there is this hope that there isn't just a complete failure of imagination and that you can kind of, you know, find some positive way of transforming those relationships.
I think in that episode, Mike, that you've written very sympathetically about the ex-husband who does drugs in the sense that, like, he really makes a jerk of himself using them, and you want him, you know, as a viewer, you want him to, like, give them up. But at the same time, I hope I'm not giving too much away here, but he says at one point, you know, he talks about how hard life is and how it's harder when he's sober. And you realize that, like, he's trying to do through drugs, which she's trying to do through meditation. They're both looking for the same thing.
Yeah, they're both trying to escape some of the pain of their life, their relationship. And so, you know, to me, I did want to be able to have him articulate in a way that she could understand why it's not just about a pleasure fix for him. It's not just about him being weak or him, you know, that there is some kind of something that she can understand about why he needs that escape route.
Laura Dern, you co-created the series, and you've had the deal with HBO and brought Mike White on to write the series. Do any parts of the series come directly out of your life?
When Mike and I first talked about it, I had expressed how much I'd love to explore rage. And growing up, I was always in love with two different films, Network and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And I think, you know, in the last so many years of American politics, I was like, you know, maybe the only person who could be Mr. Smith Goes to Washington today, like true naivete, is someone who's naive or hopeful enough to take their rage to the street, who just says everything they feel and doesn't consider how you're supposed to do it and express it. So, yeah, so I always had this great longing to explore that idea that perhaps, you know, rage isn't just this negative thing, but something that could be used in a positive way, because there had been this cultural apathy so many of us, and I know Mike and I had been feeling. So my own fury at about every single news story that exists is pretty much what is taken from my life. You know, I've never been someone who's outwardly angry, so I just kind of hold stuff in and don't know what to do with it. And I think, you know, Amy's this miraculous excuse to get to explore the feelings that I certainly hold in, and I think a lot of us do, and
right,
figure out a way to do something with them.
So you found something to do with it. Put it in a TV series.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Laura Dern, it's great to talk with you. We're going to have to, we have a line in New York and a line to L.A. right now. We have to end our line to New York. So we're going to lose your end of the conversation, I regret. But thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on the new series.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your support.
And Laura Dern stars in and co-created the new HBO series Enlightened. Mike White, I hope you can stick around with us.
Sure.
Great. So thank you, Laura Dern. We'll be right back to you, Mike White. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mike White, and he co-created the new HBO series Enlightened about a woman played by Laura Dern who has this kind of like breakdown at work, goes to a holistic treatment center in Hawaii, learns how to meditate, comes back feeling like she's become her better self and is really transformed. But then a lot of that just kind of fades away when she enters the real world again and has to go back to work and deal with all the problems of life. So the series is about her trying to maintain some of what she learned on this meditation retreat and bring that into the real world and the difficulty of doing it. And it's, you know, it's part comedy and it's part just a real sincere sincere expression of the difficulty of being your better self, but the possibility of actually changing. And Mike White wrote the first few episodes. He directed several of them. He also wrote the movies Year of the Dog, School of Rock, and Nacho Libre.
I wrote all the episodes, Terry.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow, I've only seen the first five, so I didn't.
I wrote them all.
It's going to be hard for you to calm down with that much work. Wow, that's a lot. Okay. So when you first started writing the series for HBO, how far ahead did you have to think of what was going to happen to each of the characters, where the storylines were going to go? Did you have to have a whole season mapped out before you can really begin so you know what your destination is?
Well, when you pitch a show, you kind of give them a sense of where the show would be going. I think it's helpful as far as sort of them getting their head around what it is. I was in a really fortunate position because they picked up the show pretty quickly and Laura was still committed to a movie that was shooting. So we had kind of a long prep period before the pilot started shooting. And because I'd had this experience before in TV where, you know, people are like, oh, we want to be in business with you, and you sell them something, but they really don't want what it is that you're trying to do, you know, and that's happened to me more than once, where it feels like they kind of don't want the thing that you're doing, but they don't want to lose you. So I was like, I really want to just write this season before we get too far down the road with this, so that HBO, if they do pick up the show, they really know exactly what it is that I want to do here. And it'll be fine if they don't want to pick it up, but I don't want them picking it up and then being like, oh, we want, you know, X. And I was just kind of a junkyard dog. And even though my agents were like, this isn't practical because, you know, you're kind of doing free work in a sense, it would just made me sleep easier because I just didn't want to be in some situation where I was kind of trying to transform the thing I wanted to do into something else that I didn't know how to do or didn't want to do.
There's another scene I want to play from Enlightened, and this is a scene from the fourth episode, and it doesn't give away any plot, but Amy, the Laura Dern character, and her ex-husband are going on this rafting trip, and there they meet the guide for this group of people who are rafting. I just want to play him introducing himself to the group that signed up for him to guide them on the rafting trip.
I've introduced myself to some of you. For the rest of you, I'm Rick. I used to write for television. Wow. Rockford Files, Mr. James Garner.
Oh, you love Rockford Files.
Kojak.
Great.
Yeah, they took all my ideas. Who Loves You, Baby? That was my line. I did the whole Hollywood thing, but it's a special layer of hell down there. I mean, really sick. So, I'm a poet of the river now.
Cool.
What we're going to do is today we're going to be kayaking down.
So that's a scene from Enlightened. And Mike White, I think that scene is so funny. And honestly, watching it, I thought, like, this guy's got to be the real thing. Like, this is definitely a former Hollywood writer who now does, like, who's now a river guide. Who is he?
That character is a version of me, honestly. He's like this like gruff man of the river, which is not me. But there's those moments where screenwriters, TV writers who are real put upon, you know, like feel like they've, you know, I think that's the kind of quintessential condition of the TV writer, feeling like they are being pushed around by the powers that be. And so, you know, in those moments you fantasize about, you know, oh, I could move up the state and I, you know, I'll become a river guide, or I'll do some alternate form of, you know, I'll escape from this. And I sometimes I have that fantasy myself, which is like, I'm just going to open a donkey sanctuary somewhere by the beach somewhere. And so I thought that would be a funny character to send them down the river.
Okay. I want to go back to kind of where we started from, which is that, you know, after you kind of had this stressed out meltdown because of pressures from a TV show that you were writing, you took a break, learned how to meditate for a while, and then went back to work. Now, you've been on the show several times, and we've talked about this before, but you grew up in, you know, a religious family, you know, fundamentalists, evangelicals, and your father, Mel White, ghost wrote the memoirs for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and other people on the Christian right, and then later came out as gay and really tried so hard to get Jerry Falwell to change his beliefs about homosexuality. I think he failed on that.
I think so.
Yeah, but anyways, you know, a lot of people, when they went through the kind of meltdown that you had, would have turned to a more Western religion. You turned to Buddhism, but not in a religious sense, just in, like, learning the practices of meditation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and studying, you know, just studying, I don't know exactly what you studied, but, you know, studying Buddhism. But anyways, how did you know that what you wanted to turn to was something that had more to do with meditation than with something more literal about God?
Well, truthfully, somehow I got into reading certain Buddhist sort of self-help books. There's this writer, Pema Chodron, and then from her I would start reading other books, and I was just kind of a autodidact or a dilettante just going through the section in my bookstore. But the truth was that those books became, I mean, I still read them all the time. In fact, that's mostly what I read these days. I find it very, I don't know, it can kind of you know, if I'm not actually sitting and meditating, I can get into that frame of mind. And I did grow up in a Christian household, but I always felt like there's this element to the organized aspect of religion that I just never got it. And then I, you know, in the secular world and this, you know, schooling that I had, you know, I went to college during the early 90s when, you know, all of this French deconstructionist philosophy, this critical theory stuff that I was reading. And it was all about how nothing is true and all our institutions are false and how, you know, all of the constructs that we create that are these fallacies that we live our life under. And all at the time I was like, this is the truth. And it was, you know, really stimulating and exciting for me. And at the same time, at some point you come to the end of it and you're like, okay, well, what now? If everything is false and it's all a lie and, you know, we're, you know, even our personalities are fraudulent or whatever, you know, how do you live a constructive and creative and positive, hopefully, life beyond just poking holes in all of the falseness? And I think that's what attracted me to Buddhism in a sense, because I think it comes from this place where it starts at, you know, there is no truth with a capital T, and there is no, you know, there's no self even, but that there's something about, you know, engaging in the world of compassion and other people's suffering, that is what our purpose here is. And that's something as a writer and as a person, it just didn't bump me. You know, there's just, when I would read other sort of religious writings, there was always something that I just was never comfortable with. And something about some of this, particularly Tibetan Buddhist writing, it was just like, oh, I could read this and I'd be like, you know, all of this I agree with. And it actually feels nourishing in some kind of internal way for me. And so I enjoy reading that stuff.
Well, that's a nice thought to end on, and very much connects to Enlightened, your new series. So thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with the series. It'd be well, and thank you.
Awesome, Terry.
Mike White speaking to Terry Gross in 2011. He and Laura Dern, who also visited with Terry during that conversation, are co-creators of the HBO series Enlightened, which returns for season 2 on January 13th. And on January 8th, season 1 will be released on DVD. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead salutes some of his favorite saxophonists who died this year. This is Fresh Air. Jazz lost some great saxophonists in 2012, including David S. Ware, John Chikai, Bayard Lancaster, Farouk Bey, Hal McCusick, and Red Holloway. Fresh Air's jazz critic Kevin Whitehead remembers three of his favorite saxophonists who passed away this year: Vaughn Freeman, Lowell Coxhill, and Sean Bergen.
Tenor saxophonist Vaughn Freeman, who passed away in August at age 88. Chicago's most esteemed jazz musician liked to stay close to home. He once raced back from a concert in Berlin to play a bar gig the following night. Freeman rarely missed one of his legendary Tuesday night jam sessions, where he'd school young musicians by inviting them to find their own solutions to the problems he posed. He once explained his teaching method. They ask me questions, and I say I don't know. Freeman wanted young players to put their influences and original ideas together for themselves, the way he had. Vaughn Freeman, from his 1975 reissue, Have No Fear, one good introduction to his music. Freeman came out of jazz's swing and bebop mainstream, but could relate to free jazz expressionism. Like many others, he amalgamated Lester Young's behind-the-beat honks with Coleman Hawkins's sophisticated harmony. But Vaughn capped it with an eccentric tone quality all his own. He pushed the limits of good intonation, but could still land square on pitch. That could also describe the English saxophonist Lowell Coxhill, who died in July at 79. On soprano sax, Coxhill stretched notes like taffy. It gave him an instantly recognizable sound. Lowell Coxhill honed his rubbery style playing on London streets in the 1960s, developing the art of solo soprano before celebrated colleagues Steve Lacy and Evan Parker. Coxhill's style was peculiar but internally consistent. Pitch, tone color, and the beat were all subject to continual fine-tuning. But there was also something very British about it, like he was a piper romping around the maypole. Like Vaughn Freeman, Lowell Coxhill worked a lot with younger musicians. He'd been playing jazz for over a decade when, starting in the late 60s, he found congenial company with next-generation free improvisers and rock musicians. Coxhill recorded with singer Kevin Ayers, the Canterbury band Caravan, and punks The Damned, among others. Producers used his slippery sound as a tuneful special effect. Soprano saxophonist Lowell Coxhill on Tom Newman's Superman. The South Africa-born alto and tenor saxophonist Sean Bergen, who died in September, played on London streets himself before spending decades in Amsterdam, composing, organizing bands, running jam sessions, and teaching younger musicians. Bergen's tenor sound was big and blustery, like the man himself. It was as if the music was bursting from his horns, but he wasn't one to forsake melody as he surfed over a band's rhythm. Sean Bergen on his 1987 masterpiece, Kids Mysteries, the debut from his little big band, The Mob. Where Von Freeman played blues and standards and Lowell Coxhill loved to free associate, Bergen wrote tunes to unleash his massed forces, tunes that might recall South African street music. Bergen had big appetites, not least among them a hunger to play, but he also recognized that the music wasn't just about him, that sometimes you have to subsume yourself into the ensemble and give the solos away. The music Sean Bergen made was bigger than him or his saxophones.
Fresh Air's jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is the author of Why Jazz. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Kevin Griffin, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. From the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we do our end-of-year wrap-up in TV and film. I'll give you my top 10 and bottom 5 shows of 2012, and our film critic, David Edelstein, stubbornly refuses to keep to a top 10 list. He'll give us his top 12 films of the year. Join us.